Gerald Ford is 61 years old, born in Nebraska, raised in Michigan. During the Senate hearings last fall on his nomination to succeed Spiro Agnew as vice president, he characterized his political philosophy this way.
I consider myself a moderate, certainly on domestic affairs, conservative on fiscal affairs, but a very dyed-in-the-wool internationalist in foreign policy.
John Hart has taken a look at Ford's voting record during the years he served in Congress.
When it came to money, Ford made conservatives happy and liberals unhappy most of the time. He wanted protection on trade, less foreign aid. He voted against the minimum wage bill his first year in Congress and again in 1960 and 1966 and 1973. He voted against public housing and rent subsidies. He voted against federal aid to secondary schools and for aid to universities. He voted against Medicare and the rat extermination bill, saying the rat bill would benefit only 2.5% of the people. He voted against money for mass transit, model cities, and urban renewal. He voted against creating the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And he voted against the war on poverty when the Office of Economic Opportunity was created in 1964. Ford voted against farm supports frequently, and for a number of business supports. The government guarantee of $250 million loan to Lockheed when it was in bad trouble, and he tried to keep the supersonic transport alive. As for labor, the AFL-CIO figures Ford voted wrong most of the time. He voted to keep right to work in the Taft-Hartley law, and he voted against workmen's compensation for migrant workers. His record on civil rights is more liberal than his reputation, the NAACP saying he wound up voting for a lot of civil rights bills that he tried all along to defeat and couldn't. When Sam Rayburn was Speaker of the House, he used to tell new congressmen, to get along, go along, and Ford seems to have done that most of the time.
John Hart. Our congressional correspondent, Roger Mudd, takes a more personal look at Gerald Ford.
Gerald Ford is what he is. He is a conservative, small-town Midwesterner, business-oriented with a good education. This means he is not exciting, but he is reliable. He is not funny to be with, but he's pleasant and of good cheer. He is not quick, but he is careful. In short, he gives the impression of quiet competence, vigor, sincerity, and unswerving integrity. Perhaps too much has been made of his intellect or alleged lack of it. It is fair to say simply that he is not a philosophical person. His mind does not bend that way, and during many days of public hearings and innumerable chances to ruminate about the world, the nation, the presidency, and the Congress, Ford never once answered in a philosophical or contemplative way. Nonetheless, Ford's nomination was never in real danger on Capitol Hill, even though his detractors said the country could do better. Even Clarence Mitchell, the Washington director of the NAACP and a critic of Ford's civil rights voting record, recently gave Ford the highest accolade a politician can bestow. He is, said Mitchell, the sort of man I'd be glad to go hunting with. I know I wouldn't get shot in the back.
Roger Mudd. As he left his home in Virginia this morning to begin a day that will see him sworn in as the nation's 38th president, Gerald Ford had these thoughts.
A feeling of sadness on the one hand and expectation to start to build on the other. It does strike me as a terribly heavy responsibility, which we're going to try and work on and do our very best.
Now, this message.
It's acid indigestion and this pressure. It's gas again.
Digel has told you acid indigestion and heartburn are often accompanied by gas. Now, a report from the U.S. government confirms that the only ingredients recognized effective against both acid indigestion and gas are an antacid combined with simethicone. That's exactly what Digel is. No antacid alone relieves like Digel does. Use only as directed. Digel relieves acid indigestion, relieves gas too.
I'm Johnny Bench. I play baseball, so I keep my body in good shape. I like to be well-groomed, too. So I switched underarm sprays till I found one that gives me what I want. New Body All Powdery Spray without talc. I get the comfort of powder, yet it's almost invisible on my skin. And the deodorant, like it says on the label, is micro-encapsulated, so it keeps releasing fresh deodorant at the first hint of moisture. New Body All Powdery Spray without talc. I'll never switch again.
Newsbreak. I'm Gary Shepard, CBS News.
Neil, for the last several minutes, the persons invited to this historic swearing-in ceremony have been filing into the East Room. They're members of Congress, the leadership, members of the Nixon cabinet, and we understand many of those members of the Nixon cabinet will continue on as part of the Ford cabinet. Melvin Laird is here. Melvin Laird, about whom there's been so much speculation as a possible vice presidential nomination. There is no sign. Oh, I do see at this moment John McCormick, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, where Gerald Ford spent so much of his public life and his career, has just come in. We heard the helicopters landing on the South Lawn a few minutes ago, and we understand that former Speaker John McCormick was flown here for this occasion. He is in the process at the moment of talking with Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and present Speaker of the House, Carl Albert. The East Row, Neil, is as full, I think, as I've ever seen it. It is jammed full with reporters, with photographers, with cameramen, and there's just not an inch of space anywhere except the focus, the center of the room, where we are waiting for the new president, Mr. Gerald Ford, to be sworn in by the Chief Justice Warren Burger. And Mr. Ford will be accompanied here by members of his family. They will be arranged, as we think they've laid out spaces on the stage for the family to be arranged around the new president as he takes his oath of office as the 38th president.
Gerald Ford has emphasized his congressional background by inviting the leadership of the Congress, members of both parties, to be here for this affair. There is also some of the trapping of the more formal inauguration we're familiar with on January 20th. Members of the Diplomatic Corps are in the East Room. And, of course, as you mentioned, members of the, we must now call the Ford cabinet. We know at least the Secretary of State Kissinger is staying on. Last night, the Interior Secretary, Rogers Morton, told us he'd been asked to stay on and would gladly.
Neil, among the guest list here, there's an interesting group called the Transition Group, which consists of Bryce Harlow, for a counselor to President Nixon, Bill White, the U.S. Steel, and Phil Buchan, a Grand Rapids attorney and longtime friend of Gerald Ford, and a couple listed as Mr. and Mrs. Bill Scranton. And now,
Warren Burger is being introduced, the audience rising. The Chief Justice flew back this morning from a vacation in Holland to administer the oath to Gerald Ford. Everybody waits. He has not yet appeared in view of the standing audience. Already on Capitol Hill, the Senate has passed a resolution calling Gerald Ford a good and faithful friend and pledging the cooperation of the Congress as he assumes the presidency. That resolution introduced jointly by the Republican leader Hugh Scott and the Democratic leader Mike Mansfield.
And now
the Chief Justice Warren Burger in his black robes is making his way up to the podium at the front of the East Room, standing by one of the yellow chairs.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States and Mrs. Ford.
Last time we saw Gerald Ford this morning, he was on the South Lawn of the White House bidding goodbye to Richard Nixon, who is now flying westward. Now he's making his way into the East Room. The applauding standing members of the audience up onto the podium with his wife in a light blue dress, stands between Gerald Ford and Chief Justice Warren Burger.
Mr. Vice President, are you prepared to take the oath of office as President of the United States?
I am, sir.
If you will raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Gerald R. Ford, do solemnly swear.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability.
And will, to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
The first person possibly to speak those words. Congratulations, Mr. President. Gerald Ford, his wife, now the Chief Justice.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Mr. Chief Justice, my dear friends, my fellow Americans, the oath that I have taken is the same oath that was taken by George Washington and by every president under the Constitution. But I assume the presidency under extraordinary circumstances never before experienced by Americans. This is an hour of history that troubles our minds and hurts our hearts. Therefore, I feel it is my first duty to make an unprecedented compact with my countrymen. Not an inaugural address, not a fireside chat, not a campaign speech. Just a little straight talk among friends. And I intended to be the first of many. I am acutely aware that you have not elected me as your president by your ballots. So I ask you to confirm me as your president with your prayers. And I hope that such prayers will also be the first of many. If you have not chosen me by secret ballot, neither have I gained office by any secret promises. I have not campaigned either for the presidency or the vice presidency. I have not subscribed to any partisan platform. I am indebted to no man and only to one woman, my dear wife. As I begin this very difficult job, I have not sought this enormous responsibility, but I will not shirk it. Those who nominated and confirmed me as vice president were my friends and are my friends. They were of both parties, elected by all the people and acting under the Constitution in their name. It is only fitting, then, that I should pledge to them and to you that I will be the president of all the people. Thomas Jefferson said the people are the only sure reliance for the preservation of our liberty. And down the years, Abraham Lincoln renewed this American article of faith, asking, is there any better way or equal hope in the world? I intend on next Monday to request of the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the President pro tempore of the Senate the privilege of appearing before the Congress to share with my former colleagues and with you, the American people, my views on the priority business of the nation and to solicit your views and their views. And may I say to the speaker and the others, if I could meet with you right after these remarks, I would appreciate it. Even though this is late in an election year, there is no way we can go forward except together. And no way anybody can win except by serving the people's urgent needs. We cannot stand still or slip backwards. We must go forward now, together. To the peoples and the governments of all friendly nations, and I hope that could encompass the whole world, I pledge an uninterrupted and sincere search for peace. America will remain strong and united, but its strength will remain dedicated to the safety and sanity of the entire family of man, as well as to our own precious freedom. I believe that truth is the glue that holds government together, not only our government, but civilization itself. That bond, though stained, is unbroken at home and abroad. In all my public and private acts as your president, I expect to follow my instincts of openness and candor with full confidence that honesty is always the best policy in the end. My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not of men. Here, the people rule. But there is a higher power. By whatever name, we honor him, who ordains not only righteousness but love, not only justice but mercy. As we bind up the internal wounds of Watergate, more painful and more poisonous than those of foreign wars, let us restore the golden rule to our political process, and let brotherly love purge our hearts of suspicion and of hate. In the beginning, I asked you to pray for me. Before closing, I ask again your prayers for Richard Nixon and for his family. May our former president, who brought peace to millions, find it for himself. May God bless and comfort his wonderful wife and daughters, whose love and loyalty will forever be a shining legacy to all who bear the lonely burdens of the White House. I can only guess at those burdens, although I have witnessed at close hand the tragedies that befell three presidents and the lesser trials of others. With all the strength and all the good sense I have gained from life, with all the confidence of my family, my friends, and my dedicated staff impart to me, and with the goodwill of countless Americans I have encountered in recent visits to 40 states, I now solemnly reaffirm my promise I made to you last December 6th to uphold the Constitution, to do what is right as God gives me to see the right, and to do the very best I can for America. God helping me, I will not let you down. Thank you.
Applause of this audience. Mr. Cal. members of the White House staff, diplomatic corps, leaders of the Congress present for this occasion. It's notable that the Vice President, or the President now, has stated that he will seek the privilege of speaking before a joint session of the Congress next Monday to lay out his views and seek the views of the Congress, and has gone on immediately beginning his work with what, of course, is a Congress dominated by the opposite party, by saying he would appreciate meeting with the Speaker and other leaders of the Congress immediately following this address in the East Room of the White House. Mr. Ford noted that he takes office under extraordinary circumstances, that this is an hour of history. He said, I am acutely aware that you were not elected, that I was not elected by your ballots, but he asked the American people to confirm him by their prayers. He took rather direct note of the Watergate tragedy, which has led to the departure of President Nixon, saying that our long national nightmare is over, our Constitution works, our great republic is a nation of laws and not of men. And he spoke of binding up the internal wounds of Watergate, which he said are more painful and more poisonous than those of foreign wars, a more direct reference to the problem perhaps than any made by Richard Nixon last night or this morning as he took his farewell. And we noted that President Ford's voice broke as he asked for prayers for Richard Nixon and said, may our former president who brought peace to millions find it for himself. In the East Room now, Hal Walker.
Neil, I was reminded a few minutes ago by our colleague Phil Jones of the line that the former vice president often used in speaking around the country when he would say that all he ever wanted to be really was Speaker of the House, an ambition that he never attained. But he did become vice president, and he said, once in a while, I have to admit that when I drive past the White House on my way to my house in Alexandria, Virginia, a little wee voice does come up and say, if you lived there, you'd be home now. Well, President Jerry Ford is at home now in the White House. The crowd of dignitaries, the leadership of the Congress, members of the cabinet, new advisors, new faces here at the White House who will be advising this new president as the transition takes place from the administration of Richard Nixon to the administration of Gerald Ford. Mr. Ford's family seated in the front row, beaming proudly, smiling, the mood completely different from the mood that we witnessed here in the East Room just a few hours ago as Richard Nixon departed. And now the crowd waiting to go out, a bit of a jam up at the doorway. A little while earlier we heard one of the service bands playing the martial music that so often accompanies the ceremonies in this room.
It's very much the case, Hal Walker. The transition is now made. As they say in monarchies, the king is dead, long live the king. But we now have a new president already on Capitol Hill. We have the passage of a resolution by the Senate promising cooperation with him, and we have a good deal of speculation about what man he will name now as his vice president, who must be confirmed by a majority vote of each house of the Congress. This morning, Hugh Scott, the Republican leader, and the Republican Senator Everett Brooke of Massachusetts have both come out in support of Nelson Rockefeller, the former governor of New York. Governor Ronald Reagan of California, however, is pushing Senator Barry Goldwater. So it's one of the decisions that President Ford now has to make in the coming days. And this afternoon, he goes directly into 2 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time into a meeting with his economic advisors tackling the nation's now number one domestic problem, and that is the state of the economy.
And as you noted, his saying, Neil, these transitions do take place rapidly. President Gerald Ford's first official act then will be to meet with the joint leadership of the Congress, his old friends from Capitol Hill, friends among whom he feels obviously comfortable and I'm sure will be seeking from them their pledge for assistance during these first, which will be rather trying, rather difficult days. It's always difficult when a new administration comes into the White House, just sort of finding your way around, just many of the simple physical logistical problems that have to be taken care of. And this new president, like all new presidents, is going to need all the help he can get.
And Hal, let's listen again now to some of the words of President Ford as he seems to indirectly promise at least a much more open administration than that we have just seen.
I believe that truth is the glue that holds governments together. Not only our government, but civilization itself. That bond, though stained, is unbroken at home and abroad. In all my public and private acts as your president, I expect to follow my instincts of openness and candor with full confidence that honesty is always the best policy in the end. My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over.
So Gerald Ford has taken the oath of office as the nation's 38th president. As he noted, every president since George Washington has taken that oath. It is laid down in the Constitution, Article 2, Section 1. The words of that oath, the same oath that Richard M. Nixon, that proposed Article 2 of impeachment, was accused of violating and abusing his power under it. But taking those words now and saying that these are extraordinary times, Gerald Ford has become president of the United States. This has been a CBS News special report. The nation's 38th president takes office. I'm Neil Strauser with Al Walker, CBS News, Washington.